live and direct from my phone to your ears. Welcome to my voice notes. Hello, beautiful people, and greetings from freezing Berlin, and welcome to my voice notes. Lots of new goodies for you, so let's get right to it with a track that I just discovered here in Berlin recently at a semi-illegal night. And this night kind of reminded me of the golden years of Berlin, where the vibe had something of the early days of Cookies, as some of you might remember, where there was no address, no phones, slightly illegal, but 100% good vibes. And I thought those precious spaces have disappeared, but I guess they still exist here and there. And one track that caught my ear was a track called Africa My Number One by General Chi Duncan. From Berlin to London, as a couple of weeks ago I was invited by my friend and founder of Business of Fashion, Imran Ahmed, to join him at this year's BOF conference, also known as Voices, at Soho Farmhouse in the beautiful English countryside. I was supposed to be a speaker, but my fellow guests could not make it, which in the end was absolutely okay with me, as I got to listen to some wonderful people and learned a thing or two. From Malala to Victoria Beckham to Fecal Matter, a broad spectrum of opinions and great stories. But it was one conversation that I had during the Black Tie Gala between champagne and canapes with a guest which I literally only saw for a few minutes and whose name I didn't catch, so my apologies here. But it was so interesting that I had to pull out my voice memo, as he was an expert on culture, products and community, which of course I love talking about. So here we go, hope you can learn a thing or two.
I study these sorts of digital faith communities, or like internet native institutions that are like cultural projects also embedded in technology stacks that have like a real political or cultural agenda.
I mean, you just mentioned 2010s, and now it's of course 10 years out later, yeah, right? Things, technology obviously plays a big role in that as well. But how, as a brand, can you create authentic connection to an audience, to an existing or trying to get a new audience? And let's use this word that everybody uses, community.
Yeah.
How do you build that as a brand? How can you, in an authentic way? Because that's the most challenging, right?
I mean,
especially with digital natives and Gen Z who see bullshit from a mile away.
Yes.
So how can you be real?
I think the least deceptive way to do this is, every head of community is basically a head of growth or a head of loyalty. That's what community means to a business. A centralized business entity is like, how do I reduce customer acquisition costs? How do I turn the spend that I would normally be paying to like buy customers with ad dollars into getting the community to talk to itself so it does that work for me? I think the crypto playbook is, it's not really even a playbook, but like cryptocurrencies represent a kind of structural innovation here, because what they've done is they have distributed ownership of these protocols to many, many people, which creates an incentive for those people to sort of form their own cultural logic on top. Like, they want to drive the number up, so they want more people to buy in. And that creates this kind of fractal profusion of different types of subcultures. So you have Bitcoin Christians, and you have Bitcoin carnivores, and you have Ethereum free market radicals, but you have Ethereum like kind of technocrats, and you have Ethereum cooperative maxis. And all of those things are expressions of the imperative to drive more buyers, but that can have many different cultural expressions. So that's one way. But that's like the kind of completely decentralized way, where there isn't a central entity driving it. And that's one of the things that's like on the other side of this gap, I think, which is very difficult. I don't know if brands can really access that authentic community from the first side.
Do you think that's then, it's not the brand, it's actually down to the individual? Like, I hate to use the word influencers, but that's what that was the role they were playing, right? Which I think is also starting to get outplayed, just because it's just completely oversaturated the market. So
I mean, yeah, and you see that because you are doing this podcast. Yeah. You interact
well,
with
well in general. I mean, just if you're just available on social media, it's just the culture we live in today, right? Like everything and everybody's an influencer. So they became just brand spokesperson basically. So what's the next step then? Like a brand can't be authentic, or most brands can't be by authenticity. Okay, building an authentic community from scratch is very difficult. Not just takes a lot of resources, but also it needs to come from a place of truth.
What does that mean, like coming from a place of truth? Because I think that's right, but like that's so hard to qualify.
Exactly.
And why would a brand do that?
Well, and here's just from my perspective and also my experience, it's how many times have you been to an event that it's just like a branded event? Let's say brand A throws a cocktail party. So you know what you're getting into. You know what the rules are. It's like so-and-so money has been spent on a performance for a cocktail. So key people invited, press was invited, blah, blah. You know you got the free cocktail and a drink and something. And then in and out. Doesn't mean there's any conversion into any sales. Or, so okay, yes, some press, but how relevant is that today, right? So, but doing, for instance, and it's called an underground. It's like the local kid designer who throws his own block party and has a cult following out of that just because it's part of the fabric. I mean,
he's not doing it for profit reasons, right?
Yeah.
Now, what's the difference between like the first scenario and Red Bull Music Academy? Explain to me there's a huge difference there, obviously. What composes that difference?
And that's the
irony.
What
is that gap?
And that was always the genius of Red Bull. Like, in the end of the day, they're just selling cans of sugar water, right? That's the product, really. But they managed to utilize that and build a marketing company out of it, which basically is what they're known for. So they don't even talk about the product. You don't even see the product barely.
And I mean, there's plenty. I mean, they do okay advertising. It's fine.
Yeah.
But then RBMA was its own thing. They hired these guys called Yada Star that, like, to do it. I don't know. I mean, the thing to me that seems like it points to what you said about truth is that, like, they gave them budget to do stuff that you would never do if you didn't actually care about the music. Like, they did stuff that you would do already if you weren't making any money at all. And so they expended huge amounts of money, like, with no return. Like, because
that's why it worked. That's why the Red Bull music can work, because it was a real, honest place.
And I think that's a model to
emulate.
Is like, there has to be somebody who cares about something much, much more than the business. And I think a lot of founders who talk about community, like wanting to build a community, like they do genuinely, honestly believe in their heart that like that's one of the primary reasons they're doing it. But I don't think that they fully... I think that has more to do with, like, their egos and how they're used to being the center of attention. Like, they are surrounding themselves with their early employees and their investors, like, people who believe in them. That kind of feels like the community to them. So there's a kind of, like, weird kind of psychological substitution going on where they talk about community, but for their customers can never experience what they authentically have, which is, like, the true believers around them. And for to do this other thing, I think you have to know yourself well enough and like know that's not really the limit. Like, what I want to create is something much more meaningful that embodies these other elements, like not just the product, but like the behaviors, the experiences people have, like the language that they use. I think founders can hear those words and be like, yeah, I want to provide people experiences, but like they have to mean something much more, much, much bigger in scope.
All right. Thank you.
That trip to London was quite fruitful, and hopefully I got more exciting news to announce very soon. And on that note, a little shout out here to our friends at Gagosian Gallery for the love. Another friend I bumped into was Sir Norman Rosenthal, which I'm sure I've mentioned many times on this podcast before, but we finally had some time to properly catch up. And this time around, again, I had to pull out my phone to share some wisdom from Sir Norman with you guys. You see, Sir Norman was, for a good 30 or more years, the head curator at the Royal Academy of Arts in London. And he's one of the few individuals who changed the game of museum shows by putting groundbreaking exhibitions on and turning quite unknown artists back then into big household names of today. From a new spirit in painting in the 70s to his exhibition of the YBAs, aka Young British Artists, in the 90s. From Julian Schnabel to George Bartlett to Anselm Kiefer or Tracy Emin or Damien Hirst. He was one of the first to show them all. So I had to ask him on your behalf, as we are all curators here, what is the key to a good curation? And I got a slightly unexpected answer, but still very beautiful.
Maybe I have a 1 minute answer.
What's that?
The art of curation. How do you approach a space when you curate?
Oh, I hate the word curate. That's my answer. I just say, do things you like. Okay? Just do as you like. That's curation. Okay? Do what you like. Do it for yourself. And maybe a couple of other people will like what you do.
I love that. But how, when you approach a space like, let's say, a white cube, how do you look at it? Like,
what do you mean?
How you put together an exhibition?
I mean, you just see what's in front of your eyes. Don't look, find. Okay.
Ciao, no. Okay.
From curating a space to sacred spaces, a beautiful book that was published by our friends at Resident Advisor to celebrate their 21st anniversary. So on that note, congratulations. A couple of months ago, the good folks over at RA had kindly asked me to write a love letter to nightlife, which of course I did. And little did I know in what great company I'll be. I'm very flattered that I'm part of this book, and I highly recommend it as it's a beautiful homage to nightlife by some of the greatest voices of the past decades. On that note, if you can get a copy still, because I believe they are sold out, but here is my love letter. Small footprint, big output. I was 15 when I first tried my hand on a pair of turntables, not knowing where the music would take me. Growing up in Cologne, I went religiously to Compact Records' weekly party at Studio 672, dancing to Michael Mayer and the rest of the label family, when minimal was at its peak. Not long after, I moved to London, experiencing the birth of electro clash and indie rock. I'd go to Nag 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 at the Ghetto, Family, and most importantly, Errol Alkan's Monday night party, Trash. Trash was my mecca, and Alkan mashing up genres and BPMs in a way I had never experienced before taught me what DJing was all about. On the flip side, time spent in Paris at André Saeva's Le Baron Club showed me that you don't always have to be a technical skilled DJ to have a fun night. It was about the art of curation, reading the crowds and playing as if you were at a house party full of friends. Then came my call to New York City with the Beatrice Inn, I call it my Mud Club experience, and the Boom Boom Room, my very own Studio 54. I worked at the latter as the music director, leading me to the same role overseeing André Balazs's hotels, including the Chateau Marmont in Hollywood, glamorous nights and beautiful mornings. But for all the long nights, gigs, parties and events over the years, my most formative experiences happened in Berlin. From Berghain, formerly known as Osgood, to Bar 25 and King Size. I was lucky enough to catch the tail end of Berlin's free and hedonistic mayhem. Nowhere in the world could compare. One day in 2003, when I was just 18, a bunch of friends and I squeezed into my car and drove the 5 or so hours from Cologne to Berlin. We were headed to Berghain, which was still fairly new, to catch Miss Kitten, the face of Electroclash and one of the world's most in-demand DJs at the time. Berghain was well known, but by no means the institution it is today. It was just another great Berlin club. We got in pretty easily that night, probably as we arrived quite early. And I vividly remember how mesmerized I was walking to that venue for the very first time. It was otherworldly, cold, mysterious, dark and dangerous, but exciting as hell. What is this place? I thought to myself. It was as if I'd stepped into the Wizard of Oz, but instead of Judy Garland, I was greeted by a thumping techno. We spent the night sipping on Club Mate, waiting for Kitten to come on. And I recall entering Panorama Bar and the feeling of excitement that rushed through my body. It felt as powerful as the machinery once housed in the former power station I was now dancing in. There were chains hanging from the ceiling, bright tiles on the walls, ravers dancing with abandon. When Kitten appeared, the rooms exploded. People were ecstatic. She was playing a banging set when suddenly the room went completely dark. The now infamous shutters, a new concept back then, opened very slightly. It was an unforgettable moment. You couldn't hear or see one another, and then all of a sudden, the room was illuminated. It wasn't the strobes or the lasers, but the lights from the lighting outside, shooting across the dance floor. The thunder was the techno booming from the speakers. Everyone in the room, including Miss Kitten, lost their minds. At that moment, I knew I was in the midst of a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It's been captured in my memory ever since. We stayed a while longer, thinking 7 a.m. was a pretty good stint, only to be greeted, as is true to Berghain still now, by a queue of hundreds of people standing in the rain, waiting for the chance to try and get in. My biggest takeaway from this special night was that implementing something small or simple can create extraordinary output. Berghain has no need for crazy lighting, table service, phones, social media, promoters, or egos. If you can create something positive, honest, and authentic, people will gravitate towards it. That in itself creates longevity and legacy. It's my mantra in my own work: small footprint, big output. With a goal of creating little pockets of joy for people to take with them for the rest of their lives. Talking about sacred spaces and electronic music, I'd love to shed some light to a great record label and collective from Tehran, Iran, called Adapter Records. Since the protests started, they went radio silent, as there are currently more important things going on. But I wanted to share it with you guys, as it's just another beautiful reminder how we're all the same and how music connects beyond politics and borders. Follow them, send them some love, dive into the music, as there is some serious good music out there. And I picked for you guys a little snippet from a set by an Iranian Turkish artist, and her name is Shell Well. We'll be right back. from Iran to New York City. There were a couple of cool new highlights for me, and one was definitely this new listening bar in Brooklyn called Eavesdrop, and it's definitely worth a visit. A fantastic sound, wonderful staff, and overall a really good vibe. And as we all know, listening bars are the current hype all around the world that originally hailed from Japan, but this was a new take on it, so very interesting and, yeah, highly recommended. Another now infamous retrospective at MoMA is by our friend of the show and wonderful superstar artist, Wolfgang Tillmans. The show is ending now in the beginning of January, actually January 1st. So if you're in New York, go run, go and see. It's totally worth checking out. From New York to Celine at the Wilton, a one-night extravaganza created by none other than Adi Sliman to unveil the brand's 2023 winter collection. But in full Adi manner, this was more of a rock show than a runway show. We got to go and observe Adi's vision up close, and he did not disappoint. The Age of Indiness was the title of the show, and we were greeted by a thundering sound coming out of the speakers. And it was none other than the White Stripes' 2000 classic, Hello Operator. A strutting guitar riff perfectly matching the strut of the models. But the grand finale was definitely the live performances by Iggy Pop, The Strokes, Interpol, and a DJ set by our friends The Kills. Adi at its best, which reminded me of the good old days when he changed the game during his early 2000s at Dior Homme, when he blurred the lines between fashion and music, and one influencing the other. And it always had fantastic and marvelous show soundtracks. Some of my favorite soundtracks until this day are definitely by 8Legs, These Great Days, by The Rakes, The World Was a Mess But His Hair Was Perfect, and In the Morning by Razorlight. I guess you can see a pattern here. And why don't I play you the beautiful, slightly emotional These Great Days by 8Legs. I wish we hadn't changed. I wish we hadn't kissed goodbye to those old days. I wish we'd stayed the same. These great days. Now, to wrap up this year's voice notes, let's end with the late composer and maestro Angelo Badalamenti. His music brought so much joy to all of us, especially to David Lynch, but he was also mentioned more than once in our interviews. So here are some of our highlights.
Sometimes in actors, you have a double, you know, somebody to sing for you, so it looks like you're singing very well. But because I speak English funny, they couldn't find somebody who can mimic me and also sing. And so David said, you try. And we were shooting the film in Wilmington, North Carolina, and he had a band of young kids, and they were playing it very happy and rock and roll. And I just said, no, I can't play it that way because she's sad and she's desperate. And in that moment when she's on stage, she's safe because it's the only moment when she's safe, and she loses herself in these songs. And so I was very firm at saying, David, and David agreed that that the song should have been interpreted by the character. And we didn't know, you know, who could help us because we were not musicians. And Fred Caruso was the producer, said, oh, I have a friend who does a lot of jingles, Angelo Badalamenti. He's really easygoing. And this adorable person came like, like an uncle, warm, funny. And music came so easy to him. You want it this way, you want it that way. And David fell in love with Angelo. And since they've worked and he
together,
did all the music. Yeah. But the first collaboration was to make me sing and help me sing the way I wanted to sing Blue Velvet.
Incredible.
And so it was a great moment.
I think it started with a David Lynch. I don't remember whether it was before or after Mulholland. It was probably just after Mulholland Drive. And we love cinema and we love Lynch anyway. And the soundtracks of Lynch are very special. Yeah. I mean, they define his language as much as the images and the photograph, very much so. So it's this famous composer, Angelo Badalamenti, who wrote for Lynch. So there's something a little bit freaky and makes you anxious about the sound. You know, there's something bad happening.
It's like a fog.
Yeah, it's like a fog. So this is the base and the starting point. And then on top of that is the idea that we would compose the sounds of a house. The key when you open the door.
Yeah.
Some steps in the snow. So it's really the evocation of the domestic life, what happens in a house, what power can a sound get, which looks nothing, but then it can be really strong when a door opens, when a window or the wind or... So it's really about describing what's a house through sound with a David Lynch mysterious package.
I think it's great.
On that note, thank you all for listening. For following, for dancing, for crying, and for laughing with us. It was a marvelous and crazy year, but I can't wait to share what I got for you guys in the new year. On that note, I wish you all a wonderful Christmas and a fantastic new year. Until then, toodaloo, and I'll speak to you soon. Much love.